Welcome to the Molecular Therapy Podcast. I'm Dr. Rory Bricker-Anthony, scientific editor of the Molecular Therapy family of journals. This episode features a conversation between Dr. Daniel Stone, associate editor-in-chief of Molecular Therapy Methods and Clinical Development, and senior staff scientist, Infectious Disease Sciences, Vaccine and Infectious Disease Division at Fred Hutch Cancer Center, and Dr. Mario Meech, assistant scientist, Department of Biochemistry and Molecular Biology at the University of Florida, and Dr. Robert McKenna, professor and director of the Center for Structural Biology, Department of Biochemistry and Molecular Biology at the University of Florida. They will discuss a recent article published in the Biomanufacturing and Gene and Cell Therapy special issue of Molecular Therapy Methods and Clinical Development by Drs. Meech, McKenna, and colleagues, titled Production and Characterization of an AAV1 VP3-Only Capsid, an Analytical Benchmark Standard. If you enjoy today's conversation, you'll also enjoy the upcoming ASGCT Policy Summit in Washington, D.C. on September 23rd and 24th. This can't-miss event brings together policymakers and gene and cell therapy experts, including FDA leaders Julie Tierney and Dr. Nicole Verdun, to discuss the latest policies impacting this rapidly evolving field. Register now at asgct.org/policy summit for invaluable insights on navigating the regulatory landscape. That's the ASGCT Policy Summit, September 23rd through 24th in Washington, D.C. Virtual attendance options are also available. And now, Drs. Daniel Stone, Mario Meech, and Robert McKenna.
Well, hello and welcome to the Molecular Therapy Podcast. My name is Daniel Stone, and I am the Associate Editor-in-Chief of the ASGCT Journal Molecular Therapy Methods and Clinical Development. Today, we'll be discussing a paper that features in our recent special issue, Biomanufacturing and Gene and Cell Therapy, which is now available through the Molecular Therapy Methods and Clinical Development website. Now, over the last few years, it seems that the demand for large-scale GMP AAV production has exploded with the development and approval of many new gene therapies targeting a multitude of inherited and acquired diseases. And with this demand has come a need to rigorously characterize these AAV therapeutics. And new approaches to do this are constantly being developed. Now, today I'm going to be talking about one such development with Dr. Mario Meech and Dr. Rob McKenna from the University of Florida Department of Biochemistry and Molecular Biology, who will be talking about their paper, Production and Characterization of an AAV1 VP3-Only Capsid, an Analytical Benchmark Standard. It's my pleasure to introduce Mario and Rob to our audience. Mario received his PhD from the Institute of Virology at the Charité University in Berlin before moving to the University of Florida in 2015, where he is now faculty. Mario very recently joined our team at Molecular Therapy Methods and Clinical Development as an associate editor. Rob received his PhD from King's College London, did a postdoc at Purdue with Michael Rosman, then held a faculty position at the University of Warwick in the UK around about the time I was doing my PhD 2 hours up the road in Manchester, before joining faculty at the University of Florida in 1999. Now, as many of our listeners are probably aware, Mario and Rob, along with the late Mavis Egbanje McKenna, have been, between them, been at the forefront of parvovirus and AAV structural biology for the last 3+ decades. If you've seen an AAV structure anywhere, be it on the internet, a slide, a poster, or a paper, chances are it was determined at the University of Florida. We're very lucky to have such well-known members of the SGCT community with us today. Mario and Rob, thank you very much for agreeing to join us. Welcome to the podcast. So I thought I'd get us started today by asking, what was the purpose for initiating this work? Why did you make a VP3-only construct in the first place, and how did you go about this?
Okay, so I'll start off sort of giving a big background about our lab. So as you know, as you said, we're structural biologists, and we look at single-stranded DNA viruses in general, and obviously the AAV is one of those viruses. So we're always looking to see the structure of what these things and how they look there and the biophysical properties of these particles. So as most of your audience would know, AAV capsids are composed of three viral proteins, these VPs, VP1, 2, and 3, and they have molecular weights of 80, 65, and 60 kilodaltons. And these VPs overlap in their C-terminus, so the VP3 is completely contained in the VP1 and the VP2 coded regions. So the bit that makes the integral icosahedral capsid is the bit of the VP3 portion. That's where that beta barrel is that creates that T equals one icosahedral virus. And this capsid is made up of 60 copies of these VP1, 2, and 3. Now, the VP3 portion of it is, as I say, the integral part of the capsid, but the VP1 and 2 are essential for biological functions. They have that phospholipase activity to allow the capsid to get out of the endosome. They also have nuclear localization sequences to direct it into the nucleus for the payload to be delivered. But what we're really going to talk about today is just the VP3 only, because that's the title of the title anyway. So usually in the wild-type capsids, these viruses are made up of these 60 copies. There's about 50 of the VP3s, 5 of the VP2s, and 5 of the VP1s, although that ratio varies dependent on expression levels of each of those in the cell that you're particularly growing up. So when we look at a normal wild-type AAV capsid, it usually has about 80% already of the VP3, and then it has 20% composed of this VP1, 2 component. So what we're going to look at, what we wanted to do previously in mass spec experiments, I should start off as well. You can knock out start codons of the VP1 and 2 very easily, obviously just taking those methionines out. And therefore, now you only have a capsid made up of VP3 only. And these things assemble into these icosahedrons because the other bits are sort of auxiliary function parts. However, when you take one of these and you do some mass spec on them, what we find is, in fact, there's two forms of that VP3, okay, because there are actually two methionine start sites for the VP3. And so pretty much what we've been playing around with on Mario's is knocking out one of those. We'll hear talk about it maybe a bit more, to generate something that's made up of an exact length of a VP3 to create a sort of very heterogeneous capsid, okay? So this work was done primarily on VP1, but you could actually do it on most of the AAVs. Actually, there's some that don't have this two alternate start sites, and that would be AAV5, 7, and 9. So pretty much what we wanted to do was to see what the integrity of the virus structure without those extra bits of protein, how it would look. That's how it started anyway.
Right. So has this, obviously there's a lot of interest in this for, a number of reasons, particularly the ones we're going to get into in a little bit, but has this kind of approach to generating VP3 on a capsid been used previously for other serotypes, or is this kind of a new thing
Mario,
from a structural perspective?
I will take care of that part of the question. So our lab already has made similar construct for other AAV serotypes, so similar to what we have here, and probably other labs have done that as well. And but we are definitely not the first one to make such capsid. And I want to refer to a story that the late Dr. Nicholas Mochitska actually told us, that of his scientific dispute with the lab of Dr. Jürgen Kleinschmidt at the University of Heidelberg. And his position was that the capsids cannot be just be composed of VP3 alone. And actually, for Dr. Kleinschmidt, it was basically had your opposing views and say, yes, you can actually make capsids that are only composed of VP3. And the difference was that both labs were using different constructs. And so what they did is they decided to exchange these capsids. And when they did that, they confirmed the results of the other person. So there was something into that. So, and all this kind of exchange led to the discovery of the assembly activating protein.
Oh, well, that's actually a really interesting point there, because a lot of, as we know, there's many thousands of people using AAV now. It's kind of exploded. But a lot of people, they'll just transfect their plasmids into cells, make their vector purify, and they're not really thinking about all these kind of things. And a lot of people don't really have never heard of AAP. You know, it was discovered, what, 10, 12 years ago, but it's still kind of relatively recently discovered, not well understood. Could you maybe kind of dive into that a little bit for us so that we could, you know, introduce it to people that aren't familiar with it and why it's important?
Sure, I can do that. So the AAP stands for the assembly activating protein that I just mentioned, and is another protein that is expressed by the adeno-associated virus, or at least most of them. And it's actually hiding inside the capsid open reading frame and in another frame of the capsid gene. And it's using another non-canonical start codon, actually a CTG, where its start site is actually in the codon 176 of the VPs, which is the region where VP2 has its N-terminus, which is not part of VP3, and ends around codon 381, which is then the VP3 region. And this AAP is needed by many AAVs to actually successfully conduct the capsid assembly. And their role is to transport the VP proteins into the nucleolus where the capsid assembly is actually happening. And so it becomes important if you make mutations of your capsid gene that overlaps with this AAP gene. So you don't want to be careful what kind of mutations you do, now that you introduce stop codons in the AAP frame, which are probably then fine for the capsid gene. But if you knock that out, you have maybe a problem. Or what you can do to circumvent it is to add your AAP gene and trans to supplement that if that is needed. But if possible, you want to maybe avoid it, to add another plasmid to transfect to your system, and just make maybe mutations that don't affect the AAP gene too much.
Yeah, so certainly an important consideration. And you know, our listeners out here who are working on, you know, all these many libraries for capsid development to discover new tropisms and stuff really need to consider this, because, you know, while you can change the capsid, you can also knock AAP and other genes into different frames, and you get a virus that doesn't work as well, even though it might work if the AAP was there. So
if they protected the AAP, yep.
Exactly. So, you know, things to be considered, very important. So, yeah, so it looks like, you know, you've got these capsids to form nicely. You did a lot of characterization of this. You know, the cryo-EM structure from, you know, I'm certainly not a structural biologist, but it seems you got, you know, a very high concordance with the wild type here. Was this expected? I think you've kind of alluded to that already, but, you know, what, did you anticipate any differences there?
Over the period of 20 odd years when we've been studying these things, we're always asked, like, when they package DNA or not package DNA, are there any changes with the capsid proteins, et cetera? So over the, and different, you know, cell lines that you grew it in as well, would you see any structural differences? So over the years, we've done many of these comparisons, and pretty much these are always the same structure. So we weren't anticipating anything different between the wild type or the capsid with VP1, 2, and 3 versus the capsid with just the VP3 only. Because, as I'd already mentioned, 80% of the wild type capsid is VP3 anyway, so it's a large percentage of it. And in this methodology of cryo-electron microscopy, at least up until recent years, we would vitrify these particles, get them in random conformations, and just add all these images together to get a 3D structure. But we would utilize that icosahedral symmetry of this virus to sort of generate that structure. So anything that wasn't occurring 60 times over satisfying that symmetry, or was disordered in some way, or low copy number, wouldn't really be seen in the final structure. So pretty much we anticipated that we wouldn't see anything unusual. And the, I think the RMSD between the two structures, the C-alphas, was 0.2 or 0.3 of an Armstrong. So it was a very, very small amount, which within our experimental parameters means that they were identical. So, yeah, we were expecting it to look pretty much the same. And we've also done some thermal studies as well before, when we've removed certain parts and we realized that the stability of the captive was pretty much dependent on this VP3 only captive, because that was all the interactions making the virus.
Yeah. So maybe as a follow-up to that, I can ask you, the work done in this study was with AAV that's produced in HEK293 cells. And obviously at the University of Florida, you've got access to the baculovirus system as well as this and stuff. So in your experience, they're being assembled in, you know, insect cells versus, you know, eukaryotic human-derived cell line. Do you see any differences in capsids through the different systems? You know, I know there's talk of how they perform differently, but, you know, from a structural perspective, maybe there's like post-translational modifications and things like that. And maybe you want to talk about that a little bit later on in relation to this, but yeah.
So when we analyzed the capsids via Cryo-EM or in the past by X-ray crystallography, we have definitely used ESA system for the production of the AAVs and then analyze these. And the answer short is actually no, there are no really structural differences that can be observed. But I guess if you would give me a blind copy of or sample of either system and tell me, okay, have a guess which system I use, with Cryo-EM, I would not be able to do that. But when you analyze these samples, there are, of course, maybe other ways to kind of differentiate these. So, for example, it has been described that the SO9 cells sometimes have a lower ratio of the VP1 proteins relative to the other proteins. So, but there are ways to circumvent this to make the expression better and subsequently get a better incorporation of that VP1 protein into the capsid to make this capsid better. And one thing maybe for the future that we're looking forward to, maybe to do that, we heard at a recent HST meeting that there are maybe now capsids made in plants as well. So we definitely look forward into analyzing these if there's any difference there. And when you, I guess, one thing to look at, like we also, another lab did before for the HEK293 system produced AAVs and the SO9 cell produced AAVs, is to look maybe at post-translation modifications. And the way to do this then, of course, mass spectrometry.
Yeah. Well, actually, that's a really nice segue into a couple of questions I have. Thank you for doing that for me about in the paper. So a couple of more specific questions, more from a perspective of somebody who doesn't really know what he's talking about in regards to the structure, you know. So in the mass spec, the denatured mass spec, it seems to be, you know, we talked about some of the different translational start sites and how you can get like little truncations in there. But you described these protein clipping events for VP3, some in the N-terminus, but there's one that at the aspartic acid 556. And I, to be quite honest, I'd never heard of that. Is this like a naturally occurring event, or is this just kind of a byproduct of the process? And, you know, maybe get into that a little bit more. In a bit.
Yeah, we're not really sure also on that one, so, Dan. So I'm going to tread carefully around answering this one. There has been evidence before of AAVs undergoing autoproteolysis, cutting themselves up from Nick's group as well before. There was a catalytic quartet that we had discovered some years ago, and this has been shown in the presence of low pH and heat that you can start getting these proteins to start cleaving themselves up. And the residues that we found in this data mentioned in this work are ones that could do that. But again, it could be more of a method of the process of looking at it rather than actually occurring in a cell. So I think the jury's out on all of this, and we really need to analyze it a little bit more. But at least we're going in with our eyes open now that we know there are these possibilities of these things happening.
Maybe I'm overthinking a little bit, but it's quite interesting because you see this mosaicism within the capsids where you've got, you know, this is just within VP3. And then when you throw in VP1 and VP2 on top of that, you know, you potentially got an AAV that could have many, many different versions of itself on there, and you know, whether there is any biological significance to this. But That's a
And
lot of grit.
that's exactly what the mass spec data is really showing, is that there is a whole load of populations within this purified AAV that we use.
And then especially with the mass spec data where you look at the wild type sample and it's very, very different to what you're producing. Things that people like me aren't really thinking about when we make a vector, we purify it and we put it in a mouse, we assume it's one thing when it's many, many different things at the same time. So this is really important. So maybe this is a good time to step into the issue of the post-translational modifications a little bit more. Seems like you picked out AAV1 specifically for this reason. I wasn't really familiar with the work that's looked at the different serotypes and how that can affect it, but could you kind of go into why you chose this one and yeah.
So there was, I guess there are different studies analyzing the AAVs by mass spec to see what post-translation modification out there. And for AAV1 was at least described to be one of those serotypes that are the least modified. And I guess a little bit of a problem that I see sometimes is that these labs and say, okay, a certain residue is modified, let's say ubiquitin or phosphorylation or sumoylation, glycosylation or whatever. But it seems like many of these events are more on the rare side. So a problem that I, or what I always didn't, let's say if I review a paper like that, so if you have like say covalent attachment of ubiquitin, then you would add approximately another 10 kilodalton to your capsid protein. But when you run a gel, the capsid repeat proteins that you see look like they always do. So you don't see a shift or, I mean, my interpretation of that is probably there's, let's say there are two capsid protein within the entire capsule that have this modification. And if you run a gel, there might be in such a minority that you don't see this necessarily. I guess it depends on how sensitive your gel is. But yeah, I guess long story short, these modifications don't happen in every chain of the capsid.
So, well, I mean, it certainly, if you look at your mass spec data, it certainly makes it look nice and clean there with the, with the chromatograms there. So, with the, your when you compare it to the AAV samples, you've AAV8, sorry, samples you've got there, you can clearly see those differences. In our lab, we do some work in HIV and in the context of broadly neutralizing antibodies, and how, we've kind of certainly studied how glycosylation of viral proteins can really influence, access to the surface. And it seems that AAV has just developed, evolved in a way that where it doesn't really kind of taking on these kind of modifications that can affect, neutralization in the same way. I mean, obviously AAV can be neutralized, but this isn't something that it's kind of adopted to shield itself, let's say. But yeah, it's certainly very interesting, to see this and important. So, as a how would I call myself? Let's call myself a translational AAV biologist. I look at this, the capsids that you've developed here, and this is not something that somebody like myself is going to use unless I'm, let's say I have an analytical instrument that like something like the Stunner or something similar to that where you can use in-house, but obviously this is going to be an important reagent for many people out there. How do you see this being used kind of throughout the community?
So obviously now, especially making these big vats of AAV for therapeutic use, there's a lot of quality control of what you can inject into a person, and you've got to know exactly what you're injecting it. So there's a lot of these techniques coming on board now to obviously check that there's samples. And this is where mass spec, I think, is being used a lot more now in the AAV field. The problem, at least up until now, and I'm not a mass spec expert, so I'm going to say tell you that first. But you need calibrants to be able to use mass spec properly. So you need this mass to charge ratios of certain entities. And my understanding is that they have, like we have SDS gels and we have our molecular weight markers or our DNA gels and we have our nucleotide markers of different sizes. The same thing is going to be needed for mass spec to identify your system. And you need a very pure sort of heterogeneous population as those calibrants. Now they use very low, yeah, the protein, I'm sorry, yeah, not heterogeneous. Thank you, Mark. Heterogeneous particles. Thank you. I told Mario to correct me if I said something wrong, so I'm glad about that. Yeah. So they have very small molecular weights like carbonic anhydrase, which is an enzyme we work on in our lab. That's only a 29 kilodalton protein. And I think the largest one they have is GROEL, which is about 800 kilodalton. And that has about 70 of these charged states in it. Its highest one is 70. And then with this variant that we've made, this AAV sort of N211V, VP3 only, very large name. But anyway, that's a 3.6 sort of megadalton entity, and it has over 170 charges. So that means that when you start using these as a calibrant and you're plotting your linear line as you're doing these things, now we have something up there in the same molecular weight ballpark of all these AAVs that we can use. And that's going to make life a lot easier because otherwise you have to extrapolate from your GROEL data sort of thing and put that line on there. So this is now where you have a data point that you can firmly now study any AAV that you work on using this calibrant on there and as a more accurate measurement for your mass charge ratios and just seeing the quality of your sample. That means now, obviously, if there are, you know, modifications to the capsid, et cetera, and changes in molecular weights and charges, you should be able to pick those up. And that was really the premise of why we tried to make this particle, was that we had a very, very clean sample. So you could use it, you know, for a calibration for a lot of these methodologies that have been developed for AAV.
Yeah. So I think for people, biologists like myself, when I think of mass spec, I think of a giant machine in a chemistry lab, you know, in the basement somewhere. And I haven't been in a chemistry class for more than 20 years, so I'm sure that's not the case nowadays. How easy is it to, you know, perform these kind of analysis, you know, with the DMT instrument that you talk about in there? Is it pretty straightforward? Is it quick? You know, people are obviously always looking for the simple way to do things, right?
My understanding is that, yeah, if you know what you're doing, it's pretty quick and trivial. But again, it's like running gels, et cetera. It's just a fancier machine, but you definitely need to calibrate it first before you, just like a pH meter. Very simple systems, but you need to have that calibration. And pretty much that's what this the whole premise of this work that we did, yeah. I don't know if I can advertise the company, but obviously Thermo Fisher was involved in this because they really wanted it for their instrumentations as well. Some of the
Sure.
systems they're selling, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly a lot of machines that are coming out now that are making it easier for people like me to just put a sample on a slide or, you know, in a chip and stick it in the machine, and then it'll give me a capsid ratio and it'll tell me how many full and empty genomes, et cetera, in there. So that's one thing I liked about this as well, because you could also see not only you're not just doing a full and empty, you could actually see the partial and even the oversized genomes in there, which was actually interesting to see that for me.
Yeah, that you could see that when we had one or two pocket, when we had the different, yes, start sites for the VP3 only. Yeah, you could see the minor form as well. Yep.
Yeah. And there was one interesting thing in there which I kind of wanted to point out, because a lot of people I think are unaware of this with AAV, is if you have an undersized genome, you can get multiple copies packaged. And this, you know, you saw some evidence of something, you know, a little bit oversized there. And a lot of people, they'll, you know, they'll make an AAV vector, but it'll be, you know, less, you know, 2 or 3 kb, but it'll be, you know, a single stranded. And this can really affect packaging of the vector. And, you know, you want to consider making the genome closer to wild type to avoid issues like this, and you know, something that you people don't consider. So this is really kind of interesting, and I like that you could see that there.
Yeah, I guess the if your genome is too small, so when the replication actually happens, you get these kind of dimer forms that similar to the self-complementary vectors would then be packaged. So yeah, that's definitely a possibility. And as you said, if you want to optimize the gene, you want to make it as close to the packaging capacity. So to avoid maybe that something else is packaged, even non-vector genomes, yes.
No, well, no. This has really, really been really great work. Now, I want to be conscious of your time here. You're very busy people, but I'd like to kind of get in a little question here. Is there anything new and interesting coming up in your labs? Anything we should be looking at that you will be willing to share with us potentially?
I suppose the one thing that we did have some posters on and at the meeting, so we could talk about is some of the work Mario's done on trying to make escape variants of some of the naturally occurring anti or human antibodies. Do you want to talk about them?
I guess, So in the past, we usually analyzed these kind of antigenic interaction to the AAVs using mouse monoclonal antibodies. And one big thing that we see now is maybe the mouse antibodies are not a good way to analyze this interaction. We would have to use really human antibodies because they appear, at least for now, to bind differently than different sides of the capsid than the mouse antibodies, or have certain preferences at least. And we are now able to, with certain new techniques, to get very high resolution structures to see the interaction between the antibodies, CDRs, and the surface loop of the capsid. And this really helps us to maybe design the capsid in a certain way to knock off these potential binding sites. So one thing, for example, for the gene therapy product, so Gensma, which is based on AAV9, we have now 21 antibodies at high resolution, and actually 16 bind all around the twofold axis, which is
Oh, wow.
pretty surprising.
Yeah.
So, and only very few bind somewhere else. So there's like a hotspot for antibodies in that region. And even though the high resolution data shows that they bind differently at the twofold, but there are certain amino acids that are contacted by almost all of these antibodies.
And they neutralize as well as an antibody that binds at the threefold, or.
So actually, all the antibodies, no matter where they bind, were neutralizing. In this case, it might be different for other AAV serotypes. Depends
Sure.
how important a certain region is for that respective serotype.
It's very interesting because, obviously everyone we know is driven in this threefold axis of symmetry. That's what's binding, that's what's neutralizing, and seems like it's as always is the case with AAV. It's far for a very simple virus, it's far more complicated. Well, no, that's really fascinating work. We've certainly looked into neutralization as probably as anyone who's been working in the translational field ourselves. And yeah, from moving from mice to primates to human, it's all over the place. We had an animal that had neutralizing titers against 9 different serotypes, and we couldn't figure it out. And knowing that you can bind to different sites on the capsid, which is it really might kind of help us explain these kind of observations. So,
And we're seeing cross-reactivity to the human antibodies to weird birds and other AAVs. So there's a lot of transport between them.
you've certainly got the work you've published in bat your bat AAV studies and all this kind of stuff. It's amazing how something's very similar despite being in very different species.
But we always discover new AAVs. It sounds like almost any animal has become
I know.
AAVs. We really wanted to and haven't found yet is a gator AAV since we had the university.
Oh, yeah. That
But we are looking for one now.
Okay, yeah. Well, you've certainly got enough of them down there in the Gainesville area. So I do not envy you at all, way across the country in Seattle.
We're debating who's going to go and collect the samples for us at the gators.
Well, Mario, that was marvelous. Thank you very much. I really appreciate the chance to chat with you today and to meet you both for the first time. I'm sure this will be the first time of many. I look forward to seeing you at next year's ASGCT meeting in person, hopefully. Now, I'd just like to finish out by just reminding everybody the title of Rob and Mario's paper, Production and Characterization of an AAV1 VP3 Only Capsid, an Analytical Benchmark Standard. That is available in our special issue titled Biomanufacturing in Gene and Cell Therapy, which is now available through our website. And thank you very much, everyone, for listening. And Rob and Mario, again, I appreciate you joining us today. Thank you very much.
Dan, we appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.